Welcome to the Speaker's Corner Show. My name is Heiko Ku. The show's broadcast every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. and repeated every Saturday at 3:30 p.m. on 104.4 Resonance FM. You can visit our website, speakerscorner.net, which is currently being updated, so have a little bit of patience with that. Or you can come down to Speaker's Corner and join us any Sunday afternoon between noon and dusk. This week's show is recording my own meeting on the 19th of April, 2009.
You're confronted by the difficulty of assembling the forces which will advocate revolutionary change in advance of the crises which lead the masses to think that there should be revolutionary change. So you have a contradiction in the dynamic of development of revolutionary forces. And you're quite right. I mean, in the last 6 months, as any of the observers who've been around here for a while will have noticed, at the meetings at Speaker's Corner, there has undoubtedly been a radicalization in the psychology of the population. Not only that, but there's also a profound questioning on the part of people who are hostile. You get a lot of people who are hostile to the ideas of socialism coming to the meeting and engaging in a serious fashion in the arguments being raised, who perhaps previously would have simply, you know, fished you down, what's he bloody talking about, twat, you know, that sort of mentality. And that has undoubtedly been subject to change in the last 6 months. So you are confronted by a global crisis of this nature, that you have on the one side the requirement of creating revolutionary forces who can foresee the pathway of the future, roughly, not exactly, but roughly foresee the type of activity, the type of organization, the type of demands, slogans, and activity necessary to advance the movement towards socialism, to strengthen the movement, to bring its major forces to bear, to organize the working class, the young people, the intellectuals who are a bit left-wing, to bring them together into a force able to bring about change. On the other side,
you mentioned you'd have to brainwash the people anyway.
When did I say brainwash?
Well, you didn't say brainwash, but
you're saying brainwash.
But what you said equivalates to brainwash.
No, what I said was that there are only some circumstances where people are amenable to the ideas of revolutionary socialism. In most circumstances, people are hostile to those ideas, not because they don't like the sound of it, partly because they've been propagandized to that it's bad ideas, but that's not the decisive thing. I've been speaking here 22 years, and right throughout those 22 years, many people who don't even agree with me will say, it's a good idea, but it won't work out in practice, right? Now, that's not brainwashing I'm engaging in. I'm merely discussing a body of ideas and a social movement throughout history. However, there are times when those ideas are seen to be in correspondence with the general movement in society. And I believe that the circumstances today are like that. A couple of years ago, or even 1 year ago, when I was standing at Speaker's Corner, and those of you who remember, there's a few of you in the audience who were here a year ago, will remember the hostility which a significant layer of the population had to the ideas I was expressing, which was rooted in the material benefit that those people were receiving from the existing circumstances in capitalism in the advanced capitalist countries. They were doing all right. Their pockets were okay. People were buying and selling. They had credit coming out of their ears. The gentleman here asked me a few minutes ago, is the crisis that we're experiencing today a genuine crisis? In other words, he says, where has the money gone? Was it real money? The fact of the matter is, it was fictitious capital. It was invented capital. I said to the gentleman a minute ago, 10 years ago, you could buy an apartment round the corner here for £100,000. 5 years ago, it had gone up to £300,000. Last year, it was £550,000.
Is that when you decided to sell it?
If you had luck and you weren't brainwashed, as you pointed out, then yes, you would have sold then. you would have sold then. However, if you were unaware, if you were being brainwashed by the television, the radio, the newspapers telling you, buy a house, they go up forever. It's a guarantee of your pension. Your future is rooted in property. Then, of course, you would be subject to the brainwashing of capitalism. And when the collapse in value comes, you are lumbered with a real debt. Now, of course, you can go bankrupt. That's what I did last year. When you go bankrupt in a country like Britain, if you're from Dubai, don't copy me. You go to jail and you remain in jail. However, if you're from England and you're in financial difficulty, quite apart from listening to revolutionary Marxists at Speaker's Corner, you do have the option of going bankrupt. And it was one of the most relieving things I did in my life. Fictitious capital. So the accumulation of fictitious capital presented a debt to be lumbered onto the mass of the population. The government took over the debts of the banks, the fictitious capital acquired by the banks. They took over those debts and socialized them. In other words, they've made you and your children and your children's children responsible for the repayment of the fictitious capital which the capitalists had acquired through their global speculative activity. The consequence of that is that the debts, the losses that they suffered, have now gone to the tune, I believe it's 12.5 million, US dollars, has been paid by governments around the world to acquire this fictitious debt. That debt will have to be repaid by the taxpayer in all the countries of the world who've acquired these debts. And of course, that's the root of the problem today, is that fictitious capital, finance capital, if you like, dominates industrial production. So the idea, of course, it's a logical thing for a capitalist. If you're a capitalist in Marx's day, you invested your capital.
But that isn't true.
What isn't true?
Well, no, I mean, the problem with capitalism and the problem with socialism is the same. Basically, that neither of them wish to be transparent, but the benefit of capitalism is the fact that you're able to talk here and have people listen to you, and therefore we're more likely to be transparent in a capitalist country because people are more likely to stand up for themselves, and therefore if the government are doing something wrong, you're likely to be able to stand up here and talk about it.
How many speakers' corners are there in the world?
There's one in New York, there's one in here, but
where's
I'm not
sure.
Where's
the one in New York?
I don't know, a friend of mine speaks there.
There isn't one, but anyway, it doesn't matter. There is one in Singapore, which I'm banned from.
One in Sydney.
There is one in Sydney.
Another one
in
Hackney.
There's one in London. There's a couple of places around the world where there are speakers' corners. So
Tiananmen Square.
So standing up and speaking, well, there was in Tiananmen Square 20 years ago. 20 years ago, but at the moment, no. They didn't allow. When I applied to speak in Speakers' Corner Singapore, they changed the rules and said no foreigners allowed.
Oh, I see. So you have to apply.
I think they
to
meant
speak.
Me. You have to apply to speak. That's right. You have to apply. That's Singaporean. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, it is.
No. But it is. Now, it's the lack of transparency.
Now, just one second. The gentleman is telling us about the lack of transparency. It's true that under Stalinism, there was a lack of democratic rights. That's perfectly true. Just the same as under capitalism, under dictatorial forms, there was a lack of democratic rights. How long have we had the right to speak?
Since forever.
On the contrary, my friend. How long have we had the right to vote?
1928.
Since forever.
Yeah, since forever. So I'm going to go with it.
See, the foundation for the psychology which argues the way you're arguing, it doesn't mean I'm attacking you, it's the foundation for the psychology which the gentleman is arguing is ignorance. In other words, they train you, brainwash you to think that you have had the right to vote, you know, the right to strike, the right to speak, the right to demonstrate throughout history. It's a lie. The right to vote was granted in Britain in 1928. How long have we had Parliament?
Since forever. Before Cromwell.
Before Cromwell, yes, a long time before Cromwell. Right back in the 13th century, we had Westminster and Parliament, right?
We've had Parliament for longer than that.
That's right. We've had people sitting in Parliament declaring that they are the genuine representatives of the country. And if you read your history books, it says the same thing. They are the representatives of Britain. And the history books are reinforced by the museums. And the museums are reinforced by the teachers and the professors and the newspapers and the magazines, which tell you, in general, that Britain has been democracy for all its history. The oldest, proudest democracy in the history of the world.
That's great, Russia.
The reality, however, is that the right to vote was granted only, and I say granted, only after struggle to win the right to vote in 1928. In other words, there will be people at Speaker's Corner over the course of the afternoon, someone will be here, who was born around that time.
But you can't have socialism under a right to vote.
You can't have so, on the contrary, my friend. The right to vote is part of the struggle for socialism.
What about Venezuela?
Part of the struggle for socialism.
Almost every year. They vote almost twice a year in Venezuela.
In Italy, they've had more prime
ministers. I'm talking about Venezuela.
The issue is...
Because they vote.
The issue is... The right to vote was extracted under capitalism by working people combining and struggling against the existing order of the division of wealth and power between those who had acquired their wealth, down through the ages to the era of the Norman conquest, who maintained that wealth up until today, and those people who acquired their wealth through capitalist expansion and through control of finance, did not want to grant the right to vote to the masses. The masses secured the right to vote in their struggle to advance their living conditions and their rights. The right to speak at Speaker's Corner was won by a movement established in the 1860s, set up by Karl Marx and the First International, called the Reform League, which struggled for the right of male franchise in 1866 to 1867. And there is incarnated in a tablet of stone, 300 metres over there, written proof and evidence over that way. Take the path there, turn right, go to the end of the Tyburn Tree. On the ground you will see the Reform League, and then check it on the internet what it was the organisation created by the London Working Men's Association, linked to the First International created by Marx and Engels in London, to struggle for franchise and for the rights of the mass of the population to bring about socialism in Britain. So the idea that socialism is an alien element struggling against the grain of society is false. It is the pathway of progress, both economically, socially, and culturally and politically, right across the entire planet. It has no national home. It is an international struggle to achieve transformation for the benefit of the majority of the population on a world scale. And that, my friend, is where the misunderstanding comes. Because people will turn around and say, socialism, well, you tried it in Russia. So the struggle for socialism is a universal struggle in which elements of socialism have been achieved in different countries. The right to free education in Britain, which everybody or almost everybody in Britain accepts as a right. They consider it the norm that they should have their children go to school paid for by the state. They consider it the norm that if someone has a heart attack, as long as he wasn't invented heart attack created by the police pushing him over and whacking him with a baton.
He died of internal bleeding, in fact.
But if someone dies of internal bleeding or has a collapse on the floor right now, we accept in Britain as civilized human beings, because we accept many of the principles of socialism, that anyone, regardless of how much money they've got, will receive whatever treatment is necessary and available within the resources of the healthcare system in Britain. We consider that a right. And the older you get and the sicker you get, the more you understand why that's the case. Right? And what the benefit of that is. Here speaketh a man who knows. Not only that, but one of the aspects, this man is a fighting man, in spite of having lost his legs. He's a fighting man who stated to me several years ago, because I've lost my legs doesn't mean I can't do anything. But the state has turned around to meet him and said, you are completely useless for society because you have not got any legs. They never asked you once in order, what work can you do, right? So here you have an idea.
35 years.
There you have an idea about the structure and the mentality fostered under capitalism. But against that structure, you have the will and aspiration of the majority to advance the living conditions and the rights of the masses, which is part and parcel of a universal struggle for the transformation of society into a society where the majority of the population own and control the commanding heights of the economy and democratically manage the resources available for the benefit of the population, by planning the economy rather than allowing capital and finance capital to dominate our lives for the profits of their own pockets, which is the nature of the system that we live under today. 500 companies...
That's also the nature of the system you're proposing, though.
Not
it's,
on
the
contrary.
It's the necessary nature of any system where there is somebody on top. Power corrupts. The more power there is concentrated in one place, the more corrupt it's going to get. The fact is that in this country, the power has access to much greater information than the rest of us do. There is no, for instance, CCTVs. How many of us get to see the images from the CCTVs? You know, we're quite happy to have them there, and yet the lowest paid members of society are the ones that watch it. I don't see that any other, you know, maybe the system would be able to work if everyone had a certain amount of power, but you can't have that because there are always people who want more power, and you can't chuck all of them in prison, first off, because you don't find out until they've already got too much power to do anything about it.
I think it's an underestimation of the ability of the majority of people, one, to question, two, to discover, and three, to administer, control, and limit the power and abuse of power of those at the top.
But the majority of people are too lazy.
Well, there is one question which we come back to at the very beginning, which was, what period is it that you get the potential for revolutionary change? It is in general the case that when people's pockets are relatively affluent and when the system is expanding economically, that they are able to buy off the acquiescence of the majority, and people will tolerate all sorts of monstrosities as long as they're doing okay. Not everybody, but a significant percentage of the population. But if that circumstance changes, then you enter into a period of questioning and the potential period of revolutionary change. An example of that is the present crisis on a global scale. The consequence of the economic crisis of capitalism for the majority of people in Britain has been relatively minor. For the majority of people in America has been also relatively minor. People aren't starving in the United States, they're not starving in England. But relative to the condition they were in a year ago, where they believed their prospects for advancement and the future were secure, where they believed that if they only got a good job, they could buy a house, then a second house, rent it out, and they would have a pension in 20 years' time, paid by the rented apartment, rented to a Polish man building another apartment. The cycle of expansion would continue indefinitely, and the British pound would get stronger and stronger, and we would be wealthy ad infinitum into the future of our lives, our children's lives, and our children's children. Now we are discovering, as the budget, I believe it's this week, will reveal, a gigantic hole in the budget of the government. In other words, of the social services, healthcare, education, welfare, pensions, disabled benefits, pensions, all the fundamental things that laid the economic foundation for political consensus within the advanced capitalist countries are about to disappear. All the securities that we were supposed to be offered by this great expansion of capitalism are about to disappear. And of course, some people learn more quickly than others. Some countries move more quickly than others. If you look at France, In the last 3 months, there have been one general strike, one mass protest after another, because they are aware, a little bit advanced, of the people in Britain, of the nature of the crisis they're confronting. The British government will impose restrictions on expenditure on healthcare, welfare, education, social services, cleaning the bins, servicing the streets, maintaining transportation. All these services will worsen as the government seeks to recoup the money that they've spent bailing out the banks and the bankers. And therefore, the conditions which give rise to the desire to act and control society are those conditions of revolutionary crisis. And we are entering such an era, not only in Britain, but across the entire planet. And there are indications of it, not only in the election or in the revolts in France, but also in the election of Obama in America. He was elected not because he was a black man, not because he proposed radical solutions, but because the economic crisis in America was considered to be proof that the entire policies advocated by George W. Bush were wrong. Now, Barack Obama has not brought about any fundamental changes, but the desire for change, which was expressed in the millions of people shifting behind Barack Obama, will not have been satiated by the election of a black president. The consequence of that will be that there will be even more waves of radical change demanded by the population, even in the United States of America. If that is the case in America, how much more so is it in India, Africa, Latin America, where revolutions will sweep in waves across the continents, as they are in Latin America today. So the idea that human beings are simply pliant tools of those above is contradicted by reality and by the condition which gives rise to people to seek to struggle to change society. For example, if you look at the events of the last 2 weeks in London, now somebody wrote an article about these G20 protests. There weren't many people on there. There were what? 5,000 people in the city, 5,000 people, 10,000 people in Trafalgar Square, 25, 30,000 people in Hyde Park. That was it. And yet, what has happened since that time has been a sea change in psychology in relation to the state and the people, in relation to the right of demonstration and the rights and activities of the police. Whereas we accepted only a year or two ago that the British Army can send Prince Harry to machine gun fire against enemy and enemies unknown, now when a newspaper salesman is beaten and killed by the police on the streets of London, the psychological response of the majority is a disgust. So it is not as simple as the gentleman was making out, that everybody is subservient and accepts. It ended up that an investment banker was the one who released the video, which enables us now to see a possibility that the police officer responsible for the murder will be charged with manslaughter. A step forward at least. So the struggle to achieve democratic control is an ongoing struggle which the mass of the population, by their attitude that there should be democratic control, begin to exercise that control.
David Attenborough said it might be time to consider limiting population control. Well, self-regulation, in other words, the Chinese strategy of perhaps a maximum of 2 children per family or even less. What do you say to that regarding the so-called third world that consumes far less resources and does far less ecological damage than where we live?
I think the question is really a misunderstanding, and it's an attempt to ameliorate an ecological crisis that David Attenborough is concerned about, rather than to deal with the root cause of the problems of the poorest people of the world, which is the nature of the capitalist system. In the last 6 months alone, 200 million people have officially moved from being in poverty to being in the category of hunger. That is an illustration of the way in which capitalism has shifted the weight of the burdens of the world crisis of capitalism onto the very poorest and weakest and most vulnerable people on the planet. And that is also an illustration, when people see people starving, as they will do over the next couple of years, that many people who are ignorant will turn around and say, well, didn't we have a pop concert for them in the year 2007, where Madonna sang a song? And after all, shouldn't that have resolved the problem? In the International Monetary Fund, I believe it was this morning, I read it on the Economist magazine, you can check it out. IMF or the UN, I can't remember which one it was. I know they're different. And they're fundamentally different, one or the other, I can't remember which one it was. There was a report this morning, I believe it was Economist, and they said it will cost £4 billion to avert millions starving over the next year. That's less wealth than Bezerovsky's got in personal property. One man. That's less than a third of the wealth of the owner of Chelsea Football Club. And yet, there is no intention on the part of the rulers of the of this planet to allocate the necessary resources to ensure that these human beings survive. In many poor countries, the rate of birth is a mechanism by which the older people find their pension. Just the same as people in London tried to buy second properties to rent them out to get a pension, so people in India have five children because they know all of them will be poor, but between them, when I become 65 years of age and ill, they will pay me some money to keep me alive. And that is one is a strategy within many countries to have more children to guarantee that you can live in old age. And so it is an economic question. Once you raise the living standards by reorganizing the economy, providing healthcare, welfare, pensions, then the birth rate automatically declines.
It's also a religious question. Look at Saudi Arabia, the amount of children they have. They have four wives and 25 kids, and they've got the wealth to support it.
Well, there are some exceptions to the rule, but in general, the richer the country is in per capita production, the lower the birth rate. And therefore, there is a tendential correspondence between birth rate and economic development.
That was the Speaker's Corner show for this week. Tune in next Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. on 104.4 Resonance FM. We'll listen to the repeat on Saturday at 3:30 p.m. Come down to Speaker's Corner and join us any Sunday afternoon. Speak if you like, or listen and discuss, or visit our website, speakerscorner.net, which is currently being updated.